Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 77.
We find our three famous disciples, that's Monkey King, Kigsy, and Sandy, locked in this ferocious battle. Three formidable demons just outside a major city. The source vividly describes the intensity. It says it was like iron brush scrubbing a bronze pot. That really paints a picture, doesn't it? A relentless struggle.
It does. And what's compelling here isn't just the action, though the action is great, but the almost poetic description of the combatants themselves.
Yeah, that part stood out.
Six different forms, six different weapons, six different physiques, six different emotions. And it goes on, six roots from six desires. It highlights that this isn't merely a physical fight.
You know? Right. It's deeper.
It's more like a clash of fundamental forces, almost symbolic in its depth.
And the weapons, they're almost characters in themselves. You've got Monkey King's iconic golden banded staff, Pigsy's trusty pig rake, Sandy's treasured staff, all battling against the demon's weapons. A square sky halberd, a long spear, a steel knife. It just sounds like pure, intense chaos.
Utter chaos.
So as the battle wears on, the conditions really take a turn for the worse. Wind kicks up, thick fog rolls in, and the whole scene just plunges into darkness.
Visibility gone.
And this is where things rapidly start to go south for our heroes.
Yeah, the source details this sequence of captures, and each one highlights a specific vulnerability or a clever trick from the demons. First up, it's Pigsy.
Pigsy, right.
His famously large ears, surprisingly, actually become a hindrance here. They flop down, cover his eyes, slow him down.
Never thought of his ears being a problem.
Who neither? But the old demon exploits it instantly. Swiftly cuts his mane, bites his collar, and just drags him off to be tied up in their golden palace.
Wow. Imagine the sight. Pigsy, usually so, you know, boisterous and tough.
Yeah, just taken down like that.
And Sandy isn't far behind him. He sees Pigsy captured, tries to sort of feign a retreat.
Smart move, usually.
But the second demon uses this truly bizarre method. It literally snorts him up by the nose.
Snorts him up.
Yeah, like inhaling snuff or something. It's wild. And Sandy, too, is quickly bound in the palace.
Okay, that's unexpected and pretty undignified for Sandy.
Totally. So with both his brothers now captured, Monkey King finds himself completely alone, facing all three demons.
Tough spot.
And he thinks to himself, you know, that old saying, a good hand cannot beat two fists, and two fists cannot beat four hands. He knows he's outnumbered.
Makes sense.
So he tries to escape with his famous somersault cloud, which normally carries him an astounding 108,000 light in just one leap. That's what, around 54,000 kilometers?
That's an incredible distance, more than the Earth's circumference, basically. He should be gone.
Exactly. Which raises the question.
How could anything possibly catch Monkey King?
Right.
Given that speed.
Right.
And this is where it gets really interesting. The pivotal moment. The third demon reveals its true form. A mighty rock. A colossal bird of prey. Its wingspan allows it to travel an incredible 90,000 kilometers. Mm. It's about 45,000 kilometers with just one flap.
One flap.
So two flaps, and it easily overtakes Monkey King. Just grabs him tightly.
Oh.
And he can't escape. He can't even transform, which is usually his go-to.
Yeah.
If he tries to get bigger, the rock just loosens its grip slightly. If he tries to shrink, it tightens.
Ah, so adapts.
Perfectly counters him. He's completely trapped. And taken back to the palace just like the others. It really shows that sheer speed isn't always the answer if your opponent has a specific counter.
That's a major setback. So all three disciples are now bound in the demon's palace.
The whole team captured.
And then, just the ultimate heartbreak moment. The venerable Tang monk, their master, is thrown down right there before them.
Oh, man.
His reaction is immediate, and it's heartbreaking. Just weeping bitterly, lamenting that even Monkey King, you know, his usual savior, is now captured too.
It's definitely a low point for the group. You see Pigsy and Sandy just join their master in tears. Total despair.
But Monkey King,
yeah. Remarkably, he keeps his cool. He actually calmly reassures them, tells them, Master, rest assured, brothers, don't cry. No matter what, no harm will come.
Even now? That's incredible confidence.
It really is. Even when Pigsy's complaining about the ropes digging like 2 inches into my flesh, Monkey King just brushes it off.
What does he say?
He says, even if it were a bowl-thick palm rope, it would just be like autumn wind passing by the ear, just pure mental fortitude shining through.
Wow, okay. But then the demons reveal their plan, and it's pretty horrifying.
Yeah, utterly chilling. They intend to steam the four monks.
Steam them?
Yeah.
Like dim sum.
Essentially, yes. Mm. They've got this whole operation going. Five demons for getting water, seven for scrubbing the pots, 10 for tending the fire, 20 for carrying these huge iron cages.
They're serious.
Oh, totally. They genuinely believe eating the monks will grant them immortality. Standard demon motivation, I suppose.
Grim.
And this is where Monkey King's strategic mind really kicks into high gear. While Pigsy is, you know, understandably terrified.
I would be too.
Right. Monkey King is calmly assessing the situation, trying to figure out if these are novice demons or master demons, just based on how they talk.
How can he tell?
Well, it starts with this little exchange. The second demon says, Pigsy is hard to steam, which, for a second, cheers Pigsy up.
A brief moment of hope.
Very brief. Because the third demon immediately follows up with, if he's hard to steam, skin him and steam him.
Oh, God. That's worse.
Much worse. And Pigsy's frantic plea, you know, don't skin me, coarse as I am. I'll be tender when the water boils.
Yeah.
It just highlights his raw fear.
Poor Pigsy.
But it's almost funny, isn't it? This sort of culinary debate revealing so much.
Yeah, in a dark way. But here's the crucial detail, right? The turning point.
Exactly. The old demon, the leader, presumably, makes the decision. He says, if he's hard to steam, put him in the bottom grate.
The bottom grate.
And this, remarkably, is Monkey King's aha moment. He instantly knows.
Knows what?
He knows these are novice demons, inexperienced.
Just from that.
It's the logic. It's simple, really, but brilliant under pressure.
Yeah.
He explains, maybe just thinks it, the text isn't totally clear, that for steaming, heat rises.
Okay, yeah. Heat rises.
So you always put the things that are hardest to cook, mm-hmm. the things that need the most heat at the top grate, to get the most steam. Placing Pigsy at the bottom means he won't get enough heat. It'll take forever to cook him, if ever. It's fundamentally flawed cooking logic.
That's actually brilliant, finding that tiny flaw.
Isn't it? It's a perfect example of critical observation under extreme duress, finding a weakness in the enemy's plan, even if it's about their monk steaming technique.
You'd think demons who want to eat monks for immortality would at least get the cooking right.
You would. It shows a critical lack of expertise.
Okay, so the little demons report the water's boiling, the monks get placed in the grates, Pigsy at the bottom.
Right, where it's cooler.
Sandy on the second grate, and Tang Monk, tragically, on the fourth grate, higher up.
Where it's hottest, which is bad news for him.
Yeah, but just as they come for Monkey King, he makes his move.
He does. He pulls out a classic trick from his extensive repertoire.
Which one?
Plucks a single hair. Just one blows on it with his magical breath.
The magic hair trick?
And transforms it into a fake Monkey King, still looking like he's tied up.
Clever. So the demons put the fake monkey in the pot.
Exactly. Meanwhile, his true self enters astral form. Basically, his spirit leaves his body, and he leaps up into the air, watching everything from above.
So he's safe, but his spot in the steamer is filled. The demons don't notice the switch.
Precisely. Very slick.
So with the fire blazing below, Monkey King looks down at his friends and master in the steamer, and he realizes his master, being mortal, he'll be cooked almost instantly up there on the fourth grate.
Yeah, the danger is immediate for him. Pigsy and Sandy might last a bit longer down below.
But he knows he has to act fast.
Yeah.
Time is seriously running out for the Tang Monk.
Which really raises that important question, doesn't it? When you're physically out of options, your body's tied up or, well, a fake version of it is.
Right. And your friends are in immediate, deadly peril. What do you do?
What's your next move? Monkey King pivots. He leverages his connections from beyond the immediate situation.
He makes a call.
Essentially, yeah. He recites a powerful spell, calling upon the North Sea Dragon King, Eoshin.
The Dragon King, okay.
It's a strategic choice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Bringing in an entirely different type of power, elemental power, to counter the immediate threat of fire and steam.
And does he show up?
True to form, the Dragon King appears instantly.
Awesome.
Monkey King quickly explains the dire situation, and the Dragon King, without hesitation, just transforms himself into a freezing cold wind.
A cold wind.
Yep. And this wind then circles under the pot between the fire and the bottom of the steamer.
Ah, so it prevents the fire from actually heating the pot.
Exactly. It neutralizes the heat source. A truly ingenious, completely unexpected solution to a seemingly impossible problem. It effectively turns the demon's own plan, their own fire, completely useless against them.
That's brilliant. Using cold to fight fire, but indirectly?
Tang Monk and the three disciples, all tied up inside this iron cage, And it's sitting right over a raging fire in Shittuo City. It's a classic sort of capture scenario,
really. That's sick, yeah.
But what strikes you immediately is how overconfident the demons are.
And that's exactly where Wukong finds his way in, isn't it?
Pretty much.
These three demon kings, they're completely wiped out after 4 days and nights trying to catch the group.
Right, must have been exhausting.
So they just decide, okay, time for a nap. They tell 10 little demons, keep the fire going, expecting the pilgrims will be perfectly steamed by, like, 5 a.m.
Very efficient, almost bureaucratic demon work there.
Yeah, yeah.
But that predictability, that's the key thing. Wukong, who's always watching, he's already on it, mm-hmm. he's up in a cloud, overhears the instructions. He's worried because it's quiet in the cage, so he flies down,
yeah.
transforms into a black fly, you know, Wukong to listen right at the cage. He's doing recon, assessing things properly, mm-hmm. not just reacting.
And this is where Wukong's mischievous side, that sort of psychologically clever part of him, really comes out.
Definitely.
Inside the cage, he hears Pigsy, old Baji, asking really comically, are they getting muffled steaming? That's what the cage covered. Or vented steaming, uncovered.
Only Baji. Thinking about the method of cooking even then.
Right. And Tang Monk, always practical, confirms the cage is uncovered.
Which makes Baji sigh with relief, basically saying, okay, we won't die tonight then. A little bit of hope based on the vented method.
But Wukong, here's this. Here's, they think they're safe for now. And you can just picture him grinning, right?
Oh, yeah.
And he deliberately flies over and covers the iron cage. Switches it from vented to muffled.
Wow. So he's not just messing with them, is he? Or is he? It feels like a bit of a psychological move.
I think it's both. Maybe to keep them on edge. Or maybe just his, you know, unique sense of humor shining through, even when things are dire.
And it absolutely works instantly. The disciples just panic.
Total freak out.
Tang Monk, Baji, Sandy Sha Sing, they immediately think, okay, now we are doomed. Muffled steaming, that relief, gone. Poof.
And Baji, being Baji, has this hilarious complaint. See, because Wukong covered it, it actually traps the heat inside, but paradoxically makes them feel colder initially as their bodies adjust.
Right, okay.
So Baji starts complaining about being cold and yelling at the little demons to add more wood to the fire.
That's brilliant.
And Wukong finds this super amusing, thinking to himself, like, cold is fine, heat is what'll kill you. It just shows the gap between his understanding and their, well, their panic.
That little moment of amusement for Wukong, it shows his strategic thinking, because right away he knows the next big problem.
Which is?
How to deal with those 10 little demon guards without waking up the three big bosses sleeping nearby.
Uh-huh.
He needs subtlety here. Major subtlety.
And he's got just the trick for that kind of precise work. He remembers this secret weapon he has stashed away.
Get this. Sleep-inducing worms.
Sleep worms? Where did he even get those?
He apparently won them years ago from the Guardian King of the Northern Gate.
How?
In a game. Guess fingers. Boise, the text says. Isn't that fantastic?
That detail tells you so much about Wukong, doesn't it? His, like, cosmic network and weird resources. He didn't just train. He played games, made connections.
Exactly. He's not just muscle. He's got this huge toolkit gathered from all sorts of weird encounters. It shows he's ready for almost anything.
So the worms, what does he do?
Throws 10 of them, one for each little demon. They go right up their nostrils and poof, they just fall asleep. Super efficient, super quiet, perfect.
But there's always one tough guy.
Always. One demon kind of resists, rubs his head, sneezes, trying to fight it off.
Uh-oh.
But Wukong's ready. Oh. He just throws two more worms at that one, like a double dose, it's called. One for each nostril.
Huh. Take that.
And down he goes.
Yeah.
All 10 guards, totally out cold.
Okay, guards are down. The immediate threat is neutralized. What's the next step in the escape?
Right, now the actual rescue starts. Wukong changes back to his real form, calls out to his master. Mm-hmm. He quickly uncovers the cage, releases Tang Monk, and those magic binding hairs Wukong used earlier just vanish. Then he frees Sha Sang, and finally Baji.
And Baji, I bet he's ready to make a run for it immediately.
Oh yeah, you can almost hear him puffing, ready to bolt. But Wukong, thinking ahead as always, stops him.
Why? What's left?
Well, Wukong need to release the North Sea Dragon King, and crucially, get their transport back. The horse. They can't walk the whole way.
Right. He's not just thinking escape. He's thinking logistics for the whole pilgrimage. Smart.
So he sneaks off quietly to the Golden Palace where the big demons are snoozing, finds the dragon horse.
And the horse is okay with this.
Perfectly fine. Because Wukong used to be the stable master in heaven, remember? The infamous
Oh, right. That humiliating job actually comes in handy here.
Exactly. A past role he hated now helps them escape. The horse is totally docile with him. He gets it ready. Tang Monk mounts up.
Okay, now they can go.
Not quite. Wukong stops them again.
Seriously, what now?
Practicalities. He reminds them they need their official travel permits, the Yuchik. They can't just wander through kingdoms without papers.
Ah, the bureaucracy of the road. Even mid-escape.
And he remembers the luggage. Can't have a pilgrimage without your stuff.
Good point. Where is it?
Tang Monk actually remembers. He says it was on the left side of the Golden Palace. And Wukong spots this glow.
A glow?
Yeah. He realizes it's the luminous pearl on Tang Monk's fancy brocaded cassock, the OU, inside the luggage. A tiny detail, but it leads them right to it.
Amazing. Okay, so luggage secured, permits presumably inside. Now they're really moving.
Wukong grabs the luggage, gives it to Sha Seng. Baji leads the horse. Wukong takes point. They head for the exit.
Freedom or...
Not quite. They try the main gate, the locked tight, sealed, and rigged with noisy alarms.
Okay, try the back gate.
Senek. The back gate. Same deal. Locked, sealed, alarmed. These demons really didn't want anyone getting out. Total lockdown.
Oh, man. So they're out of the cage, but still trapped in the city. This is where Wukong gets frustrated, right?
Exactly. He kind of sighs, saying, look, he and Baji and Sha Seng, they could just fly out. Easy.
Yeah, they're supernatural.
But the master, Tang Monk, he's mortal. Still, as the text says, within the three realms and five elements, you know, he's made of parents' turbid bones.
Meaning
he can't fly. He's bound by earthly limitations, and that's the big problem now. How do they get him out?
This really highlights that challenge, doesn't it? You've got immense power, but you're limited by the capabilities of the person you're protecting.
Precisely. And who comes up with the solution?
Let me guess. Baji.
Baji. Ever the pragmatist. And refreshingly direct, he just says, let's just climb over the wall
tomorrow.
After all that magic and fighting.
Yep. A very human, almost mundane solution to this massive demonic problem. How does Wukong react to that?
He finds it pretty funny, actually. He's worried Baji will go around telling everyone they became wall-climbing monks. And they finally get back. His reputation, you know.
He's worried about his image, even now.
But Baji cuts through that. He basically says, look, right now, getting out alive is way more important than looking dignified.
Yeah.
Survival first, image later.
Can't argue with that logic.
Nope. So Wukong, seeing no other real choice for getting the master out, he reluctantly agrees. They find a clear spot on the wall and get ready to climb. But, uh-oh. The source mentions Tang Senzang's disaster star. Sounds like things are about to go wrong. How does their escape get foiled?
Well, their luck just runs out. The three demon kings, they were fast asleep in the palace, right? But suddenly, they wake up.
Just like that.
It's described almost like this, demonic sixth sense. They just feel Tang Sanzang escaping, like an internal alarm goes off.
Wow. Okay, so no sneaking past them. What do they do? Burst in?
And not quite that straightforward. First, there's this chaotic scene in the kitchen. They rush there asking about Tang Sanzang, but the imp cooks out cold.
Out cold.
Yeah, the source says they're affected by these sleep demon bugs. So deeply asleep, you could apparently hit them and they wouldn't wake up.
Huh. So, useless witnesses. What happens when they do manage to wake some up?
Well, that's where it gets even weirder. The few they manage to rouse, they just confusedly blurt out that Tang Senzang has been 777, seven times steamed.
Seven times steamed? What does that even mean? Talk about confusing information in a crisis.
Exactly. It's just total confusion. So the Demon Kings, they rush to the actual steaming pot, and what do they find?
Let me guess, not Tang Senzang.
Right. Pot's cold, the cage grates are scattered around, and those imp cooks are just, you know, snoring away.
So, total panic now.
Complete panic. They realize he's definitely gone. So they mobilize all the city's imps. Check the front gate, check the back gate, both sealed tight.
A citywide lockdown, basically.
Yeah.
Pitch black night, but lit up by torches.
Yeah, the source says torches and fire turn night into day. And then finally, they spot them. The four pilgrims climbing the city wall.
Oh no, caught red-handed.
Completely. The old demon king grabs Tang Senzang. The second demon grabs Sandy. The third gets Pigsy, and they seize all the luggage, the white dragon horse, everything.
Total disaster, except one got away.
Exactly. Monkey King. He's the only one who manages to escape the recapture. And that becomes, well, hugely important very quickly.
Right. And you can't have a disaster without Pigsy complaining, can you? What does he say this time?
Oh, classic Pigsy. The source says he's muttering, probably quite loudly, "You heaven blessed. I said if we were going to save him completely, now we're going to be steamed again."
You can just hear him, can't you?
Yeah.
After almost being cooked before. But, okay, this recapture, you said it's a turning point. The demons don't just immediately try to steam Tang San Zhang again.
No, and that's a really interesting part. It signals a shift,
yeah.
A change in strategy.
Okay, so what happens? They bring Tang San Zhang back to the hall.
Right. But instead of the pot, Pigsy gets tied to a pillar at the front, Sandy to one at the back, and the old Demon King, he personally holds Tang San Zhang, keeps him close.
Why the change? Why hold off on the main event?
This is where the third Demon King, the Rock, steps in. And he's got this incredibly cunning, frankly quite chilling plan.
Okay.
He argues, look, Tang San Zhang isn't just some common fool. You can't just, you know, boil him up like anybody.
It's special.
Exactly. He calls him a rare item from a superior land. Something precious, exquisite, too good for a quick meal.
So what's the alternative? A fancy dinner party?
Kind of. He proposes this sophisticated method. Eating with games, music, slowly and carefully. It implies this drawn-out, almost ritualistic feast. Savoring it.
That's deeply unsettling, making a performance out of it.
It is, but the old Demon King, he's practical. He raises the obvious problem.
Yeah, but what about Monkey King? He'll definitely come back for his master.
Good point. Monkey King isn't just gonna let this happen.
And that's where the third Demon King reveals the real core of his plan, the psychological masterstroke.
Okay, I'm intrigued. What is it?
He says, okay, first we hide Tang San Zhang. Put him in an iron cabinet inside the brocade fragrance pavilion in the palace gardens. Keep him safe and hidden.
All right. Hiding him makes sense. But that's not the masterstroke, is it?
No, that's just step one. Step two is the genius, or maybe the pure evil part. They will spread a rumor, a devastating widespread rumor all through the city.
What rumor?
The rumor that Tang San Zhang has already been eaten, specifically half-cooked and eaten overnight.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Just put the word out that he's dead. Why?
It's pure psychological warfare. It's aimed squarely at Monkey King. The goal, the source says, is to make Monkey King give up completely and leave.
To break his spirit. Make him think there's nothing left to fight for.
Exactly. If he believes his master is truly gone, irredeemably eaten, maybe he'll just leave. Give up the whole quest. It's brilliant in a horrible way. Target his loyalty, his purpose.
And once Monkey King leaves,
then after maybe 3 to 5 days, when they're sure he's not coming back, then they can slowly enjoy Don Tang San Zhang without interruption.
Wow, that is devious. And the other demons?
They love it. The old Demon King, the second Demon King, they immediately agree, recognize how clever it is.
Because they do it just like that.
Instantly, Tang San Zhang is whisked away, hidden in the cabinet. The pavilion is sealed up, and the rumor machine starts grinding. That lie spreads like wildfire through Lion Camel City.
Okay, so the trap is set. Tang San Zhang is hidden. The devastating rumor is spreading. What about Monkey King, the one who got away? This must hit him hard.
Oh, incredibly hard. This section of the chapter is really about his reaction, his despair. Wow. First, though, pure rage.
Right, he wouldn't just sneak off quietly.
No way. He flies back to the original Lion Camel Cave, not the city, and just unleashes. Kills thousands of lesser imps there with his staff. Just pure, raw fury and frustration.
Venting. But then he realizes that doesn't solve the main problem, right?
Exactly. He cools down a bit and thinks, okay, a single thread can't make a line, a single palm can't clap, he can't take on that whole city by himself, killing random imps won't save his master.
So, time for strategy. What does he do? Sneak back in.
Precisely. He needs intel. He transforms himself into a small, insignificant imp and slips back into Lion Camel City, undercover mission.
And what does he hear as this little imp?
Everywhere he goes, it's the same story, the rumor. The great king ate Tang San Zhang overnight. Couldn't wait. Just ate him half-cooked.
Oh, man. Hearing that over and over.
Yeah, the text says he becomes truly anxious, Sansei. The rumor is working exactly as the demons intended. He's starting to believe it.
So he needs confirmation. Does he try to get into the palace?
He does. He observes the palace imps, notes their specific uniforms, the leather gold hats, yellow robes, red sticks, ivory plaques. He transforms into one of them, matches the look perfectly, and walks right into the golden palace.
Okay, now he's inside. Does he find Tang San Zhang?
Not Tang San Zhang. First, he finds Pigsy. tied to that front pillar, groaning.
And Pigsy recognizes him, even in disguise.
Yeah, recognizes his voice somehow. And when Monkey asks about the master, Pigsy just says, "He's gone. The demons ate him half-cooked."
Oh, wow. Hearing it directly from Pigsy.
Monkey King just bursts into tears right there. But Pigsy, interestingly, adds a little caution. He says something like, "Don't misunderstand. Keep looking. It's just what they're saying." A tiny bit of doubt, maybe?
But Monkey King is already distraught. Does he listen? Does he keep looking?
He does keep looking, still weeping. He moves further into the palace and finds Sandy tied to the back pillar.
And Sandy. Same story.
Exactly the same story. Sandy tells him Master was eaten half-cooked because the demons couldn't wait to steam him. Bashir Jasu, no ambiguity there, just confirmation of the worst possible news.
So Pigsy said it, Sandy confirmed it. From Monkey King's perspective, it must seem utterly true now.
Completely. The source uses really strong language here. His heart is pierced as if by a knife. His tears flow like water. This isn't just sadness. It's described as physical agony, total devastation.
So what does he do? Does he try to free Pigsy and Sandy then and there?
No. And this is the shocking part. In this moment of absolute despair, he doesn't attempt to rescue. He leaps straight up into the sky, flies out of the city to a mountain east of it, lands, and just collapses. He unleashes this torrent of tears and raw anguish.
He just leaves him there.
For the moment, yes. He's completely overwhelmed. It's like the invincible Monkey King has finally been broken.
And this is where it leads to more than just grief, right? It becomes a crisis of faith.
A profound one. He's weeping on this mountaintop, lamenting Tang Sanzang's horrible, pointless death, thinking about the whole journey, all the hardships. And it feels futile.
And he blames Buddha.
He does. He basically says, you know, if Buddha really wanted these scriptures in the East, why put us through all this hell? Why not just deliver them directly? Why let my master suffer and die like this? It feels like a betrayal.
That's a huge challenge to the entire premise of their mission.
It is. And he doesn't stop there. He issues an ultimatum. He says, right, I'm going to the Western heaven. I'm going to see Buddha.
To demand answers?
Yes, and more. He says, if Buddha agrees to send the scriptures east himself now, fine, mission accomplished, I guess. But if not,
is I.
Then I demand Buddha take this golden filly off my head, that controlling headband, the pook. Let me go back to my mountain, my original cave, and just be king again, amuse myself.
Segei.
He's threatening to quit, to abandon the quest entirely. Totally. He's basically saying, this quest is meaningless. My master is dead. Release me from this vow so I can go back to being the Monkey King I used to be. It's an extraordinary moment of doubt and defiance from the main hero. Wukong's trip to Lingshan, Vulture Peak. And what's striking is just how fast he gets there, despite everything.
Like lightning, the text says. Under an hour to cross that cosmic distance.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't just walk right in.
No, definitely not. He's immediately blocked by the four Vajras, you know, these powerful guardian deities.
Including the unmoving Vajra King from Kunlun Mountain, apparently.
Yeah.
And they're not impressed.
Not at all. They give him a pretty harsh scolding, basically saying he's being rude, barging in like that.
They even bring up his past wins, like against the Bull Demon King.
Yeah, like, hey, you beat the Bull Demon King. You should know better. Show some respect.
Wow. So he's already falling apart, and now he's getting lectured by cosmic bouncers. How does he react?
He just lets out this roar like thunder, just this massive sound of pure anguish.
And that gets attention.
It sure does. It reaches the Buddha, Tathagata, who's actually mid-sermon.
Teaching 18 arhats, right? These enlightened beings.
Mm-hmm. And the Buddha, he hears it, knows what's up, and sends the arhats out to receive Wukong.
Which finally makes the Vajra step aside. Kind of shows who's really in charge.
Definitely underscores the Buddha's authority and, well, his awareness of everything.
So Wukong finally gets before the Buddha. What happens then? It sounds devastating.
It really is. He just collapses, falls to his knees, weeping, can barely speak.
And starts recounting the whole nightmare, right? Lion Camel Mountain, the cave, the city.
Exactly. Telling the Buddha about these three poisonous demons, the Lion King, the Elephant King, and the Great Rock, and how they captured his master, Tang Sanzang.
He mentions he got caught himself too.
Oh yeah. He tells the Buddha how he was bound up, put in a steamer, facing, you know, boiling water and fire.
Horrifying.
Yeah.
But he escaped with help.
Yes, thanks to the Dragon King. But then he tried a rescue mission for his master and the others, Pigsy and Sandy.
Mudang and Wujing, yeah.
And it failed. They were all recaptured.
And this next part, this is the detail that just breaks him, isn't it? About Sanzang.
It's brutal. He reports, he tells the Buddha, that his master was, quote, eaten alive overnight, bones and flesh no longer exist.
Gone. Gone. And the other disciples, Pigsy and Sandy, still tied up, probably about to face the same fate.
So completely overwhelmed. What does he ask the Buddha?
He asks the Buddha to recite the loose headband incantation.
To take off the golden fillet, the thing that controls him. Exactly. He wants out. He says he wants to abandon the quest, go back to Flower Fruit Mountain, just be free again. Play freely, as he puts it.
It's not just about failing the mission, is it? It sounds like deep personal humiliation.
Oh, absolutely. He explicitly says, you know, he's the one who caused havoc in the heavenly palace, the one proclaimed great sage equal to heaven.
And he's never suffered defeat like this, ever.
It cuts right to his core identity, his pride, his sense of self, completely shattered.
So the great sage is on his knees, weeping, begging to quit.
Yeah.
How does the Buddha handle this? This is an unprecedented moment.
Well, the Buddha's reaction is interesting. He just calmly smiles. Tells Wukong to worry less.
Worry less. After hearing his master was eaten.
I know. And then he says something crucial. I recognize them. Meaning the demons.
Ah. Okay. So that immediately signals there's more going on here.
Exactly. Wukong picks up on it instantly. Asks point blank, are they related to you?
Straight to the point. Love that about Wukong.
And the Buddha basically says, yes. Well, sort of. He starts with the Lion King and the Elephant King. Says they have masters.
Masters, like powerful ones.
Very powerful. He immediately sends two top disciples, Ananda and Kashyapa,
right,
to go get Manjushri from Mount Wutai and Samantabhadra from Mount Emai.
And they are the masters, these major bodhisattvas.
They are indeed. Manjushri is the master of the lion demon. Samantabhadra is the master of the elephant. So these weren't just rogue monsters.
That's already a pretty big reveal. But then there's the third demon, the great rock. What about him?
Now, this is where the Buddha reveals something truly staggering, a connection he describes as somewhat related to himself.
Okay, somewhat related. How?
He goes way back, talks about the cosmic creation, heaven from Zi, earth from Cho, humanity from Yin, all creatures born from their union, standard cosmology.
Setting the stage.
Precisely. He identifies the Kuilin as the leader of beasts and the phoenix as the leader of birds. Very ancient, very primal forces.
Got it. Phoenix, leader of birds.
And here's the twist. The phoenix, according to the Buddha, gave birth to two beings.
Okay.
The peacock and the great rock.
Whoa. So the great rock's parent is the phoenix.
Yeah.
And the peacock. What about the peacock?
The peacock, Buddha says, was born most evil. So powerful. It could eat people from like 15 miles away. 45 li, the text says.
15 miles. That's terrifying power.
And then the Buddha drops a personal bombshell. He says while he was on Snow Mountain cultivating his ultimate golden body,
yeah,
the peacock swallowed him whole.
It what? The peacock swallowed the Buddha?
Swallowed him whole. He actually considered exiting through its rear end.
Seriously.
But decided against it, fearing it would defile his true nature, his true body. So instead, he cut his way out through its back.
He cut his way out and emerged onto Lingshan Vulture Peak.
Exactly. And his first instinct was to kill the peacock. Understandable, maybe.
You'd think.
But the other Buddhas persuaded him not to. They argued, harming the peacock is harming my mother.
Wait, harming his mother? How does the peacock become his mother?
Mm-hmm. Because he emerged from its body, effectively being reborn from it during his cultivation. So instead of killing it, they kept the peacock at Lingshan.
And gave it a title.
Canonized it as Buddha Mother Peacock Mahamayuri Bodhisattva. Turned this primal evil force into a part of the divine assembly.
That is mind-bending. So the peacock is Buddha's mother, in a sense.
And the great rock, the demon terrorizing Wukong and the others.
Is the peacock's brother, born from the same phoenix.
Making the great rock. Buddha's uncle, sort of. That's the kinship he mentioned.
Wow. No wonder Wukong couldn't handle him. Talk about cosmic connections.
It completely reframes the whole conflict, doesn't it? These aren't just random obstacles.
So how does Wukong react to this news?
Hmm.
After the initial shock about Sanzang, now this.
He actually bursts out laughing. It's such a Wukong thing to do.
Laughter, okay.
Yeah, he just quips, well, if that's the case, Buddha, you're the demon's nephew.
Trust Wukong to find the humor, even then.
And the Buddha doesn't deny it. He just agrees that, yeah, only he can really handle the great rock, given their connection.
So Wukong, maybe seeing a path forward now, tells him to go.
Urges him to go, yeah. Suddenly hopeful again.
And the Buddha agrees.
He descends from his lotus throne, gathers other Buddhas. He's going to intervene personally.
Just as he's leaving, Manjushri and Samantabhadra arrive, right? the one sent for earlier.
Correct. They show up with Ananda and Kashyapa, and the Buddha asks them a simple question.
What's that?
How long have your beasts, meaning the lion and the elephant, been gone?
And they say,
7 days.
Only 7 days. But Wukong's ordeal feels like it's been ages.
Exactly. And the Buddha points out this huge difference. He says, 7 days in the mountain, but thousands of years in the human world.
Whoa, time dilation. So what felt like maybe a week to the bodhisattvas in their realm
was potentially centuries or millennia down on Earth where the journey is happening. It really highlights the different scales of time, divine versus mortal.
That puts the whole pilgrimage in a different perspective, doesn't it? The sheer scale of it all.
It really does. And then the text describes the Buddha setting out this amazing procession.
Yeah, tell us about that.
It's him, the arhats, the jieti. Those are the protectors specifically assigned to the pilgrim's other bodhisattvas, all moving under a full sky of auspicious clouds.
A real image of compassionate power heading out to fix things.
Exactly. Ultimate divine intervention is on its way. But Buddha's instruction is, well, it's completely unexpected, isn't it? He tells Wukong, essentially, okay, go down there, fight them, but you have to lose. Don't win. Once you lose and come back up, I'll handle them myself. I mean, this raises a huge question, doesn't it? Why tell your best fighter to pretend to be defeated?
Yeah, it's totally counterintuitive. So Buddha's basically setting a trap, using Wukong as, like, bait.
Exactly. It's not about Wukong's fighting skill this time. It's about luring the demons out. It's a setup for something much, much bigger.
And Wukong, okay, despite his massive pride, he actually follows the plan. He goes down, lands on the city wall, and starts yelling, calling out the scoundrel demon king to come fight him. You can just picture the chaos down below.
Oh, absolutely. The lesser demons freak out, obviously, run to tell their kings. The head demon king wonders if maybe Wukong brought backup, but nope. The three kings, full of swagger, they just totally fall for it. They charge out onto the walls, weapons ready, no words needed.
So Wukong meets them, iron rod ready. But then, after just 7 or 8 rounds, which is nothing for him, really he pretends to be beaten, takes off, he just flees that quick. Seems almost unlike him.
It shows incredible discipline, actually. You know, Wukong hates losing, but he sticks to the script. And he doesn't just run away randomly. He somersaulted into the sky, and then, this is key, he hid within the golden light of the Buddha, vanished. He's using his speed not to escape, but to lead them right where Buddha wants them. It's a clever move, using supposed weakness as the lure.
Okay, so the demons chase him, thinking, ha, we got him. What happens then? Do they realize it's a trap?
Oh, they realize it, all right. They're flying after him, probably feeling pretty smug, and then, bam! Suddenly they're surrounded, and not just by anyone. We're talking the past, future, and present Buddhas. Plus this huge entourage, 500 arhats, these enlightened monks, and 3,000 jieti gods who are like divine bodyguards, total encirclement, no way out. The first demon king immediately panics. He's like, brothers, this is bad. That monkey's a nightmare. Where'd you find this guy?
Huh. But the third demon, man. He's got guts, or maybe he's just crazy. He actually says, brother, don't worry. Let's just charge forward, stab Tathagata, and take over his monastery.
Oh.
I mean, seriously, the audacity. You're trapped by basically god-level beings, and your plan is a hostile takeover.
Well, that bravado doesn't hold up for long, at least not for two of them. Because then, two specific bodhisattvas, Manjushri and Samantabhadra, they step forward. Bodhisattvas, for listeners, are these enlightened beings who help others. They just chant some powerful words and shout, you beasts, why haven't you reformed yet?
And just like that, what happens?
It's instant. The text says the old demon and the second demon were so scared they dared not resist. They drop their weapons, roll over, and poof, they turn back into their true forms. A green lion and a white elephant. Pretty impressive creatures, actually.
Yeah.
And the bodhisattvas use these lotus platforms, basically sacred platforms, to gently subdue them. They just put them on their backs, and the lion and elephant immediately become meek and submit.
Wow. So no big fight needed for those two.
Nope. It really shows that true spiritual power doesn't always need a battle. Sometimes just revealing the truth is enough to make the illusion collapse.
But, okay, you said two of them. What about the third one, the audacious one?
Ah, yes, the third demon. He's a different story. He did not submit. Instead, he drops his weapon and tries to fly away, straight up. He even tries to grab Wukong, who's still hiding in Buddha's light.
So who is this guy? What's his true form?
He turns out to be a great golden-winged rock, a massive mythical bird of prey. Really powerful.
Okay, so how does Buddha handle him? You can't just put a lotus platform on a giant flying rock, right?
Right. Buddha uses something, well, unique. He sees the rock coming for him, or maybe for Wukong near him.
Mm-hmm.
Buddha flashed a golden light and changes his own head, the one with the magpie's nest crown, into what looks like a piece of fresh red flesh.
Into meat. Why?
To lure the rock. The rock sees the flesh, dives in to strike it with its claw. But just as it strikes, Buddha points his hand upwards and somehow magically causes the rock's wing muscles to just seize up. Cramp instantly, so the rock can't flap, can't fly away. It's stuck right there, hovering helplessly above Buddha's head, trapped.
That is bizarre, but brilliant. So the rock is caught. Now what? Does it just give up?
Not quite yet. It actually complains. It yells at Buddha, Tathagata, how could you use such great power to trap me? And then it starts this whole argument, which is kind of amazing. It basically says, you live this poor, boring vegetarian life while I feast on humans and have a great time.
Hmm.
It's like a child arguing about fairness, almost.
Huh. So how does Buddha respond to that? This is where the weird negotiation comes in.
Exactly. Buddha doesn't just punish it. He offers a deal, a really strange one. He promises the rock that he'll make sure it gets fed.
Fed? How? He's not going to offer people, is he?
No, no. He says he will instruct all living beings across the world that whenever they do good deeds, like making offerings, they should first sacrifice to your mouth. Essentially, the rock gets first dibs on the merit, the essence of offerings made everywhere. It's this really pragmatic solution, isn't it? Instead of destroying this powerful, hungry creature, Buddha finds a way to, like, integrate it into the cosmic order, give it a role, albeit a strange one.
Wow. Okay. So turn its hunger into something almost holy, or at least managed.
You could say that. It redirects its nature, and the rock, seeing it has no other options, really, finally agrees. Having no other recourse, it had no choice but to submit.
Incredible. Just incredible. Okay, so all three demons are dealt with. Wukong can finally relax.
Well, almost. He comes out from the golden light, super grateful to Buddha, of course. But his first thought is, my master, where's Tripitaka? He's still worried sick.
Ah, right. He was captured way back. Did the demons eat him?
Thankfully, no. And ironically, it's the rock, still kind of mad at Wukong, who spills the beans. It says, apparently gritting its teeth with hatred, something like, that old monk of yours. Nah, he wasn't eaten. He's locked in an iron cabinet in the brocade fragrance pavilion back in the city.
Huh?
So even in its anger, it gives him the key info. Wukong heads back down to the city.
Perfect. So Buddha leaves then?
Yeah.
Takes the rock with him?
Yeah, Buddha heads back to his western paradise. He takes the rock, not setting it free, but making it a Dharma protector, like a guardian within his own aura, his golden light. The city, it's totally empty now. All the lesser demons saw what happened and understandably fled for their lives.
Smart move. So the rescue mission.
Pretty straightforward now. Wukong finds Pigsy and Sandy. First, they were tied up somewhere. Then they all head to this brocade fragrance pavilion.
Yeah.
They find the big iron cabinet and they can actually hear Tripitaka crying inside. Sandy uses his weapon, his staff, to break open the lock and the lid, and there he is, safe.
Oh, the relief. Must have been intense.
Huge relief. Tripitaka is obviously overjoyed, very emotional. Wukong tells him the whole story. Going to Buddha, the fight, the capture of the demons, the whole rock negotiation.
Quite a tale to recount.
Definitely. So, after all that excitement, they find some food left in the palace kitchens, have a proper meal, get their strength back, pack up their things.
And get back on the road.
Then get back on the road. They leave Shichuo City behind and continue their journey west.
Wow.